especially the visitors that we have. And we want to remind you that you are welcome to come back and study with us and worship with us when you have the opportunity, whenever that might be. We're glad to have you here this morning, and we want you to know that your presence is precious to us. We had read at the very beginning of the service, Daniel chapter 2, verses 47 through 49, where it says, "The king answered unto Daniel and said, of a truth, your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets among, seeing thou hast been able to reveal this secret. Then the king made Daniel great and gave him many great gifts and made him to rule over the whole province of Babylon and to be chief governor for, over all the wise men of Babylon. And Daniel requested of the king that he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel was in the gate of the king." And the idea of him being in the gate of the king is he's in the court of the king. He was always had access to the king, to Nebuchadnezzar, in that circumstance. Daniel was indeed a great man. We remember him with several different stories. We remember his interpretation of the vision, of the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, and we remember him from a very young age of being in the lion's den and being preserved by God in safety in the lion's den. There's a couple of other passages that I wanted to look at. One is Daniel chapter 6 and verse 3, and I have it up here on the screen. It says, "Then this Daniel was distinguished above the presidents and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm." And then you look at chapter 6 and verse 28. "So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian." Now Daniel's first notice is in the Babylonian Empire under Nebuchadnezzar. When the Babylonians were overthrown, seeing that he had been made, well, according to Belshazzar, number three in the kingdom, you'd almost think that Daniel would have been executed with the other rulers of Babylon, but he wasn't. He was preserved, and as he was preserved, he quickly gained favor with the Medes and the Persians who had overthrown Babylon. So here was one who was held in high esteem and was a great man. Now, we look at his character, we look at his behavior, the things he did, and we find in Daniel one who is worthy of imitation. As we noted, he started out being preeminent among the children of Israel. If you look back at chapter 1 and verse 3, it says, "And the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring in certain of the children of Israel, even the seed royal of the nobles, youths in whom there was no blemish, but well-favored and skillful in all wisdom, endued with knowledge and understanding, science, and such as had ability to stand in the king's palace, and that he should teach them in the learning of the tongue of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them daily portion, a daily portion of the king's dainties and of the wine which he drank, that they should be nourished 3 years, that at the end of the end thereof they should stand before the king. Now among these were the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah." Well, the first captivity of the Babylonians involved the nobility. The nobility was taken off into Babylon, and Nebuchadnezzar made them a special class and treated them well, educated them. And he thought perhaps that by doing this, he would gain the loyalty of the people. They would help him in that. Now, he also gained preeminence among the wise men of Babylon. In chapter 1 and verse 17, it says, "Now, as for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And at the end of days, which the king had appointed for bringing them in, the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king communed with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king, and in every matter of wisdom and understanding concerning which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his realm." So here were some men who showed some wisdom, young men, and who were well favored by their king. Now, as we noted at the beginning of the lesson, he was given favor, he was given command over all that was in Babylon. When Nebuchadnezzar passed away, there was a series of successors, of course, and Nabonidus was the last emperor of Babylon, but he was never home. And so when you get down to chapter 5, it talks about Belshazzar being the king, and he was the son of Nabonidus while Nabonidus was out in one of his military forays. Belshazzar was ruling at home, and because of certain things that transpired in the palace, it says in chapter 5, verse 29, then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold about his neck and made proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. So once again, we have his wisdom and his standing foretold in the book of Daniel. In chapter 6, in verses 1 through 3, it says, and it pleased Darius, this is the Mede, Darius the Mede, who was ruler over the world at the time, as soon as Babylon fell, it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps who should be throughout the whole kingdom, and over them three presidents, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might give account unto them that the king should have no damage. And this Daniel was distinguished above the presidents and satraps because he had an excellent spirit in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm. Well, this is twice in two different empires that Daniel finds such preeminence. And eventually it was done for him. Now, the question is, how was he able to rise to such power and maintain his integrity as far as God was concerned? I've heard people say, and some of you people here say, that you can't really get ahead politically, you can't rise to power politically unless there's some corruption involved. I don't know about that. That's kind of a general statement that probably is about as trustworthy as the word of our politicians. But the point is, the temptation is there, and Daniel rose to the top because of his goodness, not because he was corrupt. So we want to see what it was about Daniel that was helpful to him. Maybe it'll help us. Now, first of all, Daniel was a man of purpose. He had a reason for being. And this was seen in one of the first stories of Daniel's life where he was commanded by the king to eat certain foods, the dainties of his table, which might have included unclean meats or something else that Daniel would have felt defiled by eating, and to drink his wine. And he didn't want to do either one of those things. And so it says in Daniel 1 verse 8, but Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the king's dainties nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now if you'll notice, he purposed in his heart. He had reason. He had a foundation that would not allow him to do that. He had to uphold God and his purpose and his will no matter what the cost. Now because of this, God granted unto Daniel favor in the sight of others. In Daniel 1 and verse 9, it says, now God made Daniel to find kindness and compassion in the sight of the prince of the eunuchs. In other words, he admired his steadfastness, the fact that he had some foundation in his life for his behavior, and he had kindness and compassion for him. And undoubtedly, that helped him out a little bit later. You find the same thing happening to Joseph. You remember Joseph was sold by his brethren into captivity. He was bought by Ishmaelites who went down to Egypt, who sold him to Potiphar as a slave. And he went into Potiphar's house, and the next thing you know, he's over all of Potiphar's house. Well, Potiphar's wife likes him, and she begins to flirt with him, and he flees her presence, but he leaves his coat. Mistake. And so she accused him of making advances, and Potiphar had him thrown in jail, and it wasn't long before Joseph was running the jail. Well, why? He was a good guy, and he was active. And he was interested in other people. And he was attentive to what God said and God's promised blessings. Now, every child of God needs to be a person of purpose. A strong sense of purpose often breeds respect and the admiration of others. You talk about self-esteem. A lot of young people are raised today without any self-esteem. And so we seek to build up their self-esteem by stroking them, patting them on the head and telling them what fine people they are. But that doesn't do anything but just create a false pride, a vainglorious spirit. The way to build self-esteem, the way to make somebody strong, where they can stand on their own two feet, where they can take care of themselves, where they can have some self-respect, is to give them some purpose to pursue, some activity that becomes important to them, that becomes an integral part of their life and their activities. Teach them to do something with their hands, with their minds, with their mouth, something that is useful, something that is valuable, something that will give them purpose, a reason for being. Now, those of us who are Christians, we have purpose and meaning in our lives. We have something to do. In Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verses 13 and 14, in very general terms, Solomon talks about the purpose and meaning of life after he had spent his life, he'd wasted his life, looking for purpose in other places. He looked for purpose in building wealth, in building a great library, half of which he wrote, and wisdom, and wine, women, and song. And he said that all of that was striving after the wind. After he concluded his search, this was his conclusion. This is the end of the matter. All hath been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole of man. This is what man is created for. This is why we're here. And God does have some work for us to do. He does have a mission and a purpose for us to do. And if we don't, every work is going to be brought into judgment. Or if we pursue things that are evil, we're going to be examined on the judgment day, the last day, by God. Jesus makes it clear in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 33 that he has purpose for us. He says, "But seek ye first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you." Now, when we talk about seeking first his kingdom, the first thing that comes into our minds is abstaining from that which detracts from his kingdom, from his rule. In other words, being good little boys and girls. But there's more to it than that. Seeking first his kingdom is seeking to advance his cause, being busy in doing the work that he set forth for his children. And so we need to have that as a purpose. Seek ye first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Look at Philippians chapter 2, and beginning in verse 12, where we find that God has chosen us to accomplish his work. He says, "So then, my beloved, even as you've always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." Now, we've read this a lot lately. Working out your own salvation doesn't mean figure it out. That was not an expression that meant that back in those days. To work something out did not mean figure it out. It meant to do the things that brought it about, the things that would bring whatever your desire is to fruition. And he named what those things are here in this verse. He says, "So then, my beloved, even as you've always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation." We work out our own salvation. We bring it about by obeying God, by doing what God says. And when we do that, God saves us. Now, that's what he means, work out. It doesn't mean figure it out. He means bring it about by doing what God says. Now, in verse 13, he says, "For it is God who worketh in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure." And we've talked about this quite a bit. This is not God in me working on me. This is God in me working through me. You know, when you pick up a hammer to hammer a nail, the purpose is not to make the hammer better, but it's to drive the nail. When God picks us up and uses us to do his job, of course he's made us better. He has enhanced us by picking us up. But that's not the purpose. That's not why he's done it. He has picked us up to use us as his hammer or saw or whatever to accomplish a work and to make it better through us. We are his hammer and saw. We're his tools. And that's what he talks about when he says, "For it is God who worketh in you both to will and to work for his good pleasure." Not that he's changing me, but that he's using me. Now, there are lots of passages that talk about God changing me, but how? Through the Word, As we learn what God would have us to do in the Scriptures, then we make changes or adjustments to fit His Word, the pattern that He's given there. But here He talks about us being God's tools, His instruments. And notice the cause that we enter into as a result. Look at verse 14. He says, "Do all things without murmurings and questionings, that ye may become blameless and harmless children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom ye are seen as lights in the world." We are, as Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5, verse 14, the light of the world. But we understand that as lights of the world, we reflect His goodness. But we are seen as lights in the world. When I look at this passage, he starts verse 16 by saying, holding forth the word of life. As we've said before, it's like the Statue of Liberty. Holding forth Liberty's lamp in the harbor there in New York. Well, here we are in a dark world holding forth salvation's lamp, showing people the way not just to freedom but to spiritual freedom and forgiveness of sins and eventually to heaven. That's our job. That's our task. That's our purpose. That's why we are here. The best thing for us that could have happened is if when we were baptized, you're not going to get any cleaner than that. You come up out of that water and your sins are all washed away and your heart is totally inclined toward God and what He's doing with you. The best thing to happen at that moment is for a tornado to hit the building and just take you up. Why didn't God do that? Why doesn't God allow us to be baptized and just go right straight up to heaven? Because He has work for us to do. He has a purpose in us. And we need to see going to church a little bit differently. I know how a lot of people feel about going to church. They feel like they're going to see something. They're an audience. And they wouldn't dare call what they're going to see a show. But kind of it is. To a lot of people in the Church of Christ, it's a program. And they are the audience, and they come to observe other people, and they participate by eating a little piece of bread and drinking a little grape juice and humming along with the song in low tones. But it's a show to them, and they're customers. And if something goes wrong or if it doesn't exactly please them, it's not exciting, they just go somewhere else. We need to see this as a part of our work. Is it a part of your work? Is what goes on here at the church a part of you or a part of your work? It needs to be, because that's the way God has ordered it. We have purpose. We have meaning in our lives. Now, there's one thing that's going to separate us from everybody else as we develop in our hearts and minds the Spirit of Christ. In Matthew chapter 9 and verse 36, it says of Jesus, "But when He saw the multitudes, He was moved with compassion for them because they were distressed and scattered as sheep not having a shepherd." Okay, that speaks to His purpose and His message, doesn't it? He came to seek and to save that which was lost. But I want you to notice something else. I want you to notice what He saw. He saw a bunch of people who had no purpose. There's no unified reason. Well, yeah, they had reason that, you know, build up a pile of money so the children would inherit their wealth. They could live their retirement years in comfort and maybe move off to Florida or to Arizona or someplace where everybody ends up going when they retire. I mean, that's what a lot of people have in mind. Or they have in mind they're going to build up their family or do something for their family, or they're going to do something really silly and worthless like climbing all the volcanoes around Flagstaff, which is one of my goals. And if I do one a week, then the Lord lets me live that long, I'll probably live to be about 150 years old at the rate I'm going. But the point is, here is a world without any direction. There's no shepherds. There's no one to say, this is why we're here. This is what we need to be trying to accomplish. Parents will not teach their children that. They don't guide their children. There are no shepherds. People in the churches, they come to church, and what do they hear? Baby food, pablum. Whatever pleases the audience. And whatever pleases the audience is whatever society finds to be acceptable. They have no direction. They're collectively. Society is a collection of rolling stones. You know the song, like a rolling stone with no direction of home? You're not a Dylan fan, huh? Okay, anyway, you know what I'm talking about. People are shiftless. I'm not talking about the bums out on the street holding the cardboard signs with the Crayola on them. I'm talking about people living next door or working next to your cubicle at work who have no idea why they're here. They're just at work to make money so they don't starve to death. And then they can run off and do whatever they want to on the weekend. But I have a purpose. I have meaning in my life. And that makes me happy. That makes me fulfilled. Not having somebody stroke me and telling me what a fine person I am. I enjoy that just like the next guy does. But you know what? I found that to be, in a large number of cases, kind of hollow and empty because I know better. I know what my failings are. I know what my weaknesses are. In spite of how everybody tells me how fine I am. Or if somebody tells me what a rotten egg I am, I also know I have some good qualities. And one of these days, somebody who knows me will tell you about them, maybe, if they can think of them. Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 and 2 says, "If then you were raised together with Christ, seek the things that are above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on the things that are above, not on the things that are upon the earth." The Christian's preoccupation is going to heaven and getting as many people as he can to go with him, pleasing God, putting the kingdom first. This is our purpose. This is our reason. And it's a good reason. It sustains us. It's substantial. It won't cave in when we knock on the door of death, you know, or death knocks on our door. You want purpose and meaning in life? You know, if you find the cure for cancer, the common cold, I'm proud of you. You know what will happen? All those people that you've saved from dying from cancer, the common cold, are going to die from Alzheimer's disease. Okay? I mean, something else will have to be cured, and all your work will eventually go for naught. We appreciate it. It's great. Okay? But it doesn't last. It doesn't last. What we're dealing with here is how God is going to dispose of us at the last day. Is he going to send us to heaven? Is he going to welcome us in? Or are we going to go to the bad place? We're going to have to go to hell. Do we stand right before God or do we stand condemned before God? These are important things. And it is with this purpose that we have been imbued. Daniel was also a man of principle. He refused to compromise his convictions. Well, when he was invited to eat the king's meat and drink his wine, he refused to do that, according to Daniel chapter 1 and verse 8. As an old man, he showed his dedication to principle by refusing the reward that was promised by Belshazzar if he would interpret the meaning of the handwriting on the wall. Belshazzar was going to put a ring around on his finger and put a gold chain around his neck and make him number 3 in the kingdom. And Daniel said, "You keep that for yourself. I don't need all of that." And he told him what the handwriting on the wall was, and Belshazzar rewarded him anyway. And then later on, when Darius put out the decree that no request should be made of anyone except him, Daniel went and prayed to God anyway. Daniel chapter 6 and verse 10, which we'll have more to talk about later in a later lesson. Now, here's the point. He was a man of principle. He had things that he held to be right, and he stuck with it. He didn't give up on it. He was faithful to it. Principle is important. Look at Matthew chapter 23 and verses 23 through 26. It says, "Woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye tithe mint and anise and cumin, and have left undone the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. But these you ought to have done and not to have left the other undone." You did all right tithing these little things, but the principles of the law you have left undone. These you ought to have done and not to have left the other undone. "Ye blind guides that strain out the gnat and swallow the camel." Did he say that we shouldn't strain out the gnat? No. But if we're going to strain out the gnat, doesn't it make sense that we're going to strain out the camel too? We're not going to swallow the camel either. And what he's saying basically is that they were righteous when it was convenient. And when it wasn't, they weren't. You know, had a fellow one time deliver a wonderful lesson on the evils of gambling. And there's some things wrong with it scripturally. But he kept a couple of dollars handy so he could play the lottery. Somebody said, well, what's the deal there? He said, well, it's only $2 that I spend a week. Reminded me of me when I was in grade school. I didn't want to go to school one morning because the day before I got a paddling by the PE teacher. I won't tell you what for. None of your business. And it wasn't a federal crime, so the Freedom of Information Act doesn't cover it. My dad says, why don't you want to go to school? You like school. He says, I said, yeah, that's right, Dad, I like school. He said, why don't you want to go to school? I said, it's not school I don't like, it's the principal of the thing. Well, why? Because the principal called the PE teacher in to paddle me. Principal's important. It's important. And, you know, if it's wrong to bet $1,000 on a horse race, tell me what's right about betting a penny in penny ante poker game. It's a principle of the thing. And you give in one place, one man's penny is another man's $1,000,000. And pretty soon you learn the money's not the issue anyway, is it? It's the compulsion, the power, the hold. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 11 says that we're to have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather even reprove them. That means you stay away from sin completely. Romans chapter 12 verse 9 says, let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor that which is evil. Cleave to that which is good. And that means you have to honor the principle as far as you possibly can. God approves of people who will abide by their principles. Romans chapter 8 and verse 31 says, if God is on our side, who can be against us? And indeed, who can be against us if God is on our side? In Psalm chapter 15, verses 1 through 5, it says, Jehovah, who shall sojourn in thy tabernacle? In other words, who will you accept? Who shall dwell on thy holy hill? He that walketh uprightly and worketh righteousness and speaketh truth in his heart. He that slandereth not with his tongue, nor doeth evil to his friend, nor taketh up a reproach against his neighbor, and whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honoreth them that fear Jehovah. You see, there's not just the abstaining from evil, but there's the honoring of those who do right. He that sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not. He that putteth not out his money to interest, nor taketh reward against the innocent. He that doeth these things shall never be moved. It's a man who walks by principle. Now, let me tell you some things that I have done in the past, and maybe you've heard these things before. But in the 90s, you recall that the Boy Scouts of America were sued because they would not allow homosexual scoutmasters. Okay, they were sued. Well, they won because they're a private organization. They can do whatever they want. That's the way the court looked at it. All the way up to the Supreme Court. And Levi's makes good blue jeans, good clothes, you know, Dockers and all that stuff. They had been giving a lot of money to the Boy Scouts, but when the Boy Scouts won the lawsuit, they took all the money away from the Boy Scouts. Why? They were making a support, a statement in support of homosexuality. And I have not and will not wear another article of Levi's as long as I live. Please do not bury me in, well, I'm going to be cremated, so you might as well put me in the Levi's. They belong in the fire anyway. I won't wear them. Ben and Jerry's ice cream. Now, here is some place where we're really going to talk about commitment. You know about me and ice cream. I love ice cream. And Ben and Jerry's has some really good, unique flavors. But I will not put one spoonful of that stuff in my mouth. You know why? Well, they make a big deal out of making something like 12% of their profit contribution to nonprofit organizations. And 95% of that contribution goes to an organization that promotes homosexuality in public schools. David Baker will not eat Ben and Jerry's ice cream. Now, we talk about teachers' unions. If there's a group that needs a union, I don't know one that needs one more than teachers, because teachers are regularly abused by administrators who want to withhold money and by children who have no threat hanging over their head. In fact, if the teachers' union was serious at all, they'd go on strike until they decided to start disciplining children again. But what do education activists, including teachers' unions, support now? Well, a part of their education involves and has involved sex education, which involves, they'll talk to you more about abortion and more about homosexuality, diversity in sexual education than just about anything else. Now, somebody says, David, you shouldn't get involved in politics. And I believe that, you know, to a certain degree, you're right. But if you have a chance to speak out with reference to something that's right or wrong, and you don't do it, I think you've made a mistake, a spiritual mistake, whether it involves politics or your next-door neighbor's language or whatever. Okay? And since I've been in this place, there have been places, there have been times when you could vote in such a way so as to affect what is going to happen in this country with regard to marriage, abortion. Has anybody here ever seen an aborted child? Have you seen an aborted baby? I've seen. Okay, when you've seen that, I don't know how you feel about it now, but when you see it, it will change your heart forever. And some of you who are tender-hearted, I guarantee you at least one nightmare. At least one. Have you ever seen one? Well, I have. It'll affect you. But you have a voice. Maybe it doesn't do you any good to speak out. Maybe your vote doesn't count. Maybe somebody will cancel out your vote by shipping in 25 dead people to vote, you know. But you've got to do something. You've got to speak. You have to be consistent with what you believe and what you practice and what you advocate or what you advocate against. Be a man of principle. Daniel was a man of principle. And he was trusted. He decided what was important, and he stuck with it in spite of the consequences. That's why he was in the lion's den, friends. Solomon said, buy the truth and sell it not. Have we sold the truth? Is the truth no more precious to us than that? Interesting question. Daniel was a man of purity. His opponents could not find any fault. You look at Daniel chapter 6 and verse 4. It says, then the presidents and the satraps sought to find occasion against Daniel as touching the kingdom. But they could find no occasion nor fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. So what they do? They talked Darius into making a law that they knew Daniel couldn't keep. But even when Daniel broke that law and was cast into the den of lions, Darius couldn't sleep that night, and he ran down to the lion's den the next morning to make sure that Daniel was still there, and he was. Of course, his purity in business affairs was related to his purpose in serving God and the fact that he was a man of principle and could be trusted. The Christian also is to maintain purity of conduct. In 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 12, Timothy talks to you, if you consider yourself a young person, he says, let no man despise thy youth, but be thou an example to them that believe in word and manner of life and love and faith and purity. You know, some people don't like young people. There's some people who do not like young adults or teenagers because of the way they've been treated. They've been treated with disrespect by those people. And those people don't listen to them. They don't avail themselves of the wisdom that's there. Don't let anybody despise your youth. But you act the way that you should so that people will respect you and will listen to what you have to say. In Titus chapter 2, verses 6 through 8, it says, the younger one, likewise, be exhort to be sober-minded in all things, showing thyself an example of good works, in thy doctrine showing uncorruptness, gravity, sound speech that cannot be condemned, that he that is of the contrary part may be ashamed, having no evil thing to say of us. And then he says to the slave and the free man in the next couple of verses. In verse 9, he says, exhort servants to be in subjection to their own masters and to be well-pleasing to them in all things, not gainsaying, not purloining, but showing all good fidelity that they may adorn the doctrine of God, our Savior, in all things. In other words, behave yourself as best you can and don't be a distraction or a bump in the road for anybody. You just be the best kind of person you can in all circumstances. In Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16, Jesus said, you are the salt of the earth, but if the salt hath lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing but to be cast out and trodden under the foot of men. Salt has a distinct flavor. Christians have a distinct personality. I mean, we all are different in our personalities and so forth, but there's one thing about us that's consistent, and that is our desire to please God. And that sets us apart, just like salt is set apart by its flavor. But if the salt loses its flavor, what's it good for? So you all like salt on your fried eggs, don't you? But suppose you put the salt on your fried eggs and you couldn't taste it. Would you continue to buy the salt? Would you continue to put it on? I don't think so. It'd be a waste of time, wouldn't it? Well, the salt that has lost its flavor is thenceforth good for nothing. He says, ye are a city, are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a lamp and put it under the bushel, but on the stand, and it shineth unto all that are in the house. Even so, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. In other words, we need to maintain the purity of conduct because of the influence that we have in the world. Daniel was a man of prayer. Like I say, we're going to have more to say about this in a later lesson. But you look at Daniel chapter 6 and verse 10, where Darius had made the decree that no prayer or request should be made of anyone but him. It says there, and when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went to his house. Now his windows were open in his chamber toward Jerusalem. And he kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime. In other words, he recognized the need to pray. He got down on his knees and humbly asked God for the things that he needed and gave thanks for the things that God had done for him. He was persistent in his service to God, even when it was discouraged by the ruler of the land. Christians would do well to follow Daniel's examples. As Christians, we are to pray often. I like 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 17. If I was going to give this as a memory verse, you'd thank me. It says, pray without ceasing. That's an easy one. But you know, sometimes we forget to pray anyway, don't we? Pray without ceasing. Look at Colossians chapter 4 and verse 2. Colossians chapter 4 and verse 2, he says, continue steadfastly in prayer, watching therein with all thanksgiving. Continue steadfastly in prayer. And that doesn't mean we're just to have a continual stream of words, you know, stream of consciousness type of a prayer where we're just uttering prayer all through the day, but we make it a thing in our lives that we practice all the time. Several times a day, I find myself talking to God, and a lot of times I find myself talking to God about myself several times in the day, just almost spontaneously. Like last night, I smashed my finger. And I asked the Lord to help me not say what I was tempted to say. And it worked. You know, sometimes remembering that God is there and God hears you keeps you from doing things that you ought not to do. That's why prayer is important. James 5:16, confess therefore your sins one to another and pray for one another that you may be healed. The supplication of a righteous man availeth much and is working. I can testify to that. Prayer works. Philippians chapter 4, in verses 6 and 7, it says, "In nothing be anxious, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God, and the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, shall guard your hearts and your thoughts in Christ Jesus." We need to remember to pray, and loads of life will be lifted if we'll do that. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 12 says, "For the eyes of the Lord are upon the righteous, and his ears unto their supplication, but the face of the Lord is upon them that do evil." His ears are open to our supplication. God hears your prayer. And you may not like his answer, or his answer may not be quick enough to satisfy you, but he does answer your prayer. Now, 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 33 says, "Be not deceived, evil companionships corrupt good morals." Well, if evil companionships corrupt good morals, what does fellowship with God in the act of prayer do? It builds you up, doesn't it? You want to be strong in the Lord, strong in the faith? Pray about it. Read the Bible. Let God talk to you. And it'll work for you. Daniel found favor with God and with men as well. Our standing with God is the most important thing that we might be striving after. We must be people then of purpose, of principle, of purity, and of prayer. That's what God expects of us. Now, it may be that you're not a member of the Church of Christ. You haven't been baptized into Christ. And you may have come this morning expecting me to talk about the wonders of motherhood. And if you want me to do that, well, you just sit down and I'll tell you all about my mother. I'll tell you about the wonderful things that my mother did for me. I'll tell you the most wonderful thing she did is she brought me into this world. She let me live after all the commotion I caused. She said I was a very active baby in the womb. She didn't know whether she was going to be able to handle me. And when I was born, of all three of her children, I am the most docile and best behaved. And I never lie much or exaggerate. But we could talk about that. But let me tell you about your mother. I'm going to tell you, this is true about all of you. All of your mothers want the best for you. And the best for you can only be found in serving God and having the same hope, probably, hopefully, that your mother has of going to heaven. Now, my mother's still with me. I'm glad of that. Just really grateful that she's still around. But she won't be always. But you know, when she passes, and when her mother passed and my other grandmother passed, I know what their thoughts are right now. They're waiting for me to join them. And if I have not obeyed the gospel, that hope is lost. We won't ever see each other again. Well, the gospel is very simple. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. Have you been baptized into Christ? If not, then let us do that for you this morning. If you have been baptized into Christ, but you haven't been living the way that you should, let's get back on the track. Let's look at people like Daniel and Joseph and Jesus himself and imitate them in their faithfulness. And if you need to make some changes, then let's take care of it this morning. If we can help you, make it known by coming in front while we stand and sing.